Hello, hello, poo 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 pow. Oh, you're stuck with another episode of the Pinky Pod. How you doing out there? I say, let's just get right to it, huh? While I hear a motorcycle outside, no matter how hard I try to do this. Anyway,
I am declaring, even though it's Labor Day, that as far as I'm concerned,
spooky season has begun. Listen, y'all get to try to push Christmas in the stores and stuff, almost skipping Halloween. You know, you used to anyway, until it became more popular with people. If you're going to have
holidays like that for 2 or 3 months,
I'm declaring that it's spooky season right now. And I have a good subject for it to kick it off. Some of us are spooky all year, but I digress. So what is today's subject? Well, it's something that still has a lot of influence on us to this day. The Théâtre du Grand Guignol. It's in the Pigalle district, Paris, between the 9th and 18th arrondissement. Pigalle itself was named after sculptor Jean-Baptiste Pigalle, who was born 1714 and died in 1785. It's famous for being a tourist district, or really, you could probably call it a red light district. It's full of sex shops, theaters, adult shows. During World War II, its reputation led to it being nicknamed Pigalle by the Allied soldiers, who you know frequented it. Oh, yes, they did. Also in this area is Le Moulin Rouge, which I know you've heard of, speaking of famous and infamous. There's even a movie, right? Not only that, such people have lived there as Pablo Picasso, Vincent van Gogh, André Breton, Henri Toulouse-Lautrec had a studio there, and Josephine Baker opened her first nightclub in Pigalle. But I'm not here to tell you about all of those famous people. I'm here to tell you about horror. The Grand Guignol. It closed in 1962, but the building does still stand. It opened in 1897, founded by Oscar Meunier, and its main specialty, what made it really infamous, was naturalistic horror shows, live and on stage. In fact, it's so infamous that a lot of people to this day use its name as a general term for what is considered graphic, even amoral horror, which, by the way, is a popular genre all the way back to Elizabethan and Jacobean theater. There are plays like Titus Andronicus by good old William Shakespeare that are full of murder, blood, revenge, and cannibalism. Look it up. I actually even have the, you'd probably call it an anachronistic movie that has Anthony Hopkins in it. Check it out. The building, I think this is kind of funny and somehow appropriate in a weird way. The building that the theater is in was actually a former chapel. And they left some of that architecture inside. So you have like 7-foot angels over the orchestra. And I like to imagine that the people were sitting there going, are they watching me? Is God watching me? Are they telling God? Am I being judged? It didn't stop them from coming. But I think it really helped with the PR of the place. There were also confessionals left in there. And I don't know if these are boxes that I read about that were in the back, like private boxes. It kind of sounds like it because they mention that there's grids. And you know those old confessionals, you can kind of see through them. So the people could sit in there privately. They could watch the plays through that, but people couldn't see in. And they were very popular with couples. And I read that they were so popular that sometimes even the actors had to stop and be like, hey, are you finished in there? So yeah, they were having a good time in those boxes. Another tidbit that I read was that as far as the PR, it was not considered a good play unless you had at least one person fainting. And apparently they averaged at least 2 a night. Whether or not this is 100% true is up for debate, but they certainly leaned into this very smartly and advertised it that way. They also had a doctor on the premises, just in case. Who knows if they cared as much about the fainting of just how,
again, for PR, it looked really good to have the doctor there, but they did have a doctor.
Now, they originally were just doing sort of slice of life plays. No pun intended. Slice of life plays with subjects that were not usually done by other theaters. You know, nobody wanted to do plays about prostitutes and criminals and street urchins and basically the lower class. However, you know, the bourgeois class love to slum it out in Pigalle. That seems to be a very common pastime of some of the upper classes. You know, let's go slum it out where the poor people go and all this titillating stuff that I don't get to see in my proper home. Yeah, they were big time fans. You also had some very loyal local people as well attending. But a lot of the bourgeois set, with the promise of, you know, horror and blood and illicitness on, oh, they couldn't resist it. Someone who collaborated with Melanier was André Antoine, who was founder of Théâtre Libre, which is free theater, you could say. And they like to showcase unknowns, not famous. One that did become a little famous is Emile Zola's Thérèse Racan, which I actually have that book. And I have the version where he put a foreword in it where he throws a shit ton of shade at his critics because it was considered a very scandalous story at the time. Interesting side note about that, while I digress here, there's a Korean film from 2009 directed by Park Chan-wook called Thirst, which I have seen. You might enjoy it, by the way. It's a slow burn, but it's vampiric. It's wrapped around the story of Thérèse Racan. I was recognizing this as I was watching it. The original story has no vampires at all, okay? But they take the main story from it, and he worked it into it. And sure enough, he mentions it in the credits. He did credit that. And I just found that interesting because I didn't think hardly anybody knew about it, let alone somebody in Korea. So I thought that was really cool. And now here I have it connected to Les Grands Guignols. So I just thought that was interesting. Another little side note here is apparently some of their stuff was so scandalous, but they avoided censorship by having their plays kept alive by subscribers, not always just tickets. I guess patrons, you would say. It helped keep them open from what I read. So the type of horror that they specialized in and plays was naturalistic. This was a movement in European drama and theater during the late 19th centuries into the early 20th century, where theater attempts to create the illusion of reality through different strategies. It was especially favored by the French. And this would go for anything, not just horror. They just wanted things to be real, really realistic. Of course, then when you get to horror, this means that they're going to try all kinds of ways to use blood and you know, quote-unquote special effects, but they're going to be practical effects. There was director Max Moret, who took over from 1898 to 1914, didn't consider the horror plays a success until someone passed out. He's the one who said that. The more the better. They want it to be totally shocking. There was André Delorde, who was discovered by Maury, and he wrote at least 100 or more plays for them during his time as principal playwright from 1901 to 1926. And I was just looking up some other things, and a lot of the plays that are mentioned definitely have his byline. One interesting one was not a horror play, but it was set in the Franco-Prussian War, where a French prostitute kills a German officer. That was probably very popular considering what happened, you know, at a certain time. So it's Max Mori who really leaned into this horror stuff, okay? They would try to show things like gouged eyeballs, you know, lots of blood, squirting blood, you know, melodrama meets torture porn. But they did no supernatural stories, no ghosts, no monsters, you know, nothing like that. Which honestly, when you think about it, you don't need that because we humans are monstrous enough. And I like to say that's the best horror a lot of the times, or a mixture is always fun. But and when people wonder, like, to this day, why do we watch horror? And they criticize people who do. It appeals to all of our baser instincts, and it gives you an adrenaline rush. You're safe. You're not the victim. And you know it's fake, right? I think it's normal. And it's better than doing what people used to do and probably would still do if we held public executions. They used to go and watch this stuff. It was a big day out. It was an event. So whether we like to admit it or not, that's what humans do. So the person who was responsible for a lot of these stage techniques with the gore was Paul Ratineau. He is particularly noteworthy for inventing stage blood that congealed under the lights, which had an effect of making it look very realistic. He also did illusions, kind of like magic tricks. You know, I think he learned from magicians, like eyeballs popping out, heads chopped off, melting faces. Back in the day when they were first doing this, acid attacks were in the news. Like, these were really happening. So a good way to scare people, of course, is to play on some very real fears, correct? Timely stuff here. So they used some early prototype or early type of latex to make melty, gooey faces. There's one play that was called The Torture Garden. How do you like that for a title? You know what you're in for. Someone is skinned alive. And he used long strips of ectoplast, which when I tried to look it up, I kept getting ghost stuff, right? Ectoplasm. From what I can tell, it's probably some sort of tape, maybe a little see-through. They would paint the sticky side red, and that would be stuck to the person. That way, when you peel it off, it looks like blood coming up with it, right? And it also made a satisfying ripping sound. From what I can tell, what I saw a few pictures, the audience was very close to the stage. So not only did this have to be very convincing up close, those sound effects would have been very good for really immersing someone, right? One of the writers, the writer that I mentioned, also did some collaborations with experimental psychologist Alfred Binet, who invented the IQ test. I think with someone Simon, because it's the Binet-Simon test. This guy attended law school, was degreed in 1878, but then he studied psychology at the Sorbonne. They did a lot of plays, I guess, about insanity and this and that, so the guy was sort of a consultant. Let's get back to the plays, though. We're here for the blood and guts. What could you expect to see at a typical Grand Guignol performance? You would see at least 5 or 6 short plays. They would be brutal horror plays. And I'm going to tell you some of the behind the scenes as well as tell you a few of the plays just very quickly to give you an idea. There was Le Laboratoire des Hallucinations. When a doctor finds his wife's lover in his operating room, he performs a graphic brain surgery, rendering the adulterer a hallucinating semi-zombie. Now insane, the lover patient hammers a chisel into the doctor's brain. Oh! Un crime dans une maison de feu. 2 hags in an insane asylum use scissors to blind a pretty young fellow inmate out of jealousy. Leur belle passion. A nanny strangles the children in her care. Le basier dans la nuit. A young woman visits the man whose face she horribly disfigured with acid, and he gets his revenge. Ho-ho-ho! Also, before I get to the behind the scenes, which is going to be very interesting, I think, I want to tell you that this was, of course, panned by some critics, as critics love to do, because it does, you know, they were concerned that it was feeding people's baser instincts, right? Although artistically, it was respected as far as the writing and the acting and the performers. They still were able to recognize that those were good. The scream queen of the day in the Grand Guignol was Paula Maxa, who we can maybe look up more about her. I'll put pictures of her on my Instagram, Pinky_podcast. You had major writers, including Gaston Leroux, who was the author of The Phantom of the Opera, did plays for it. Maurice Renard, who wrote The Hands of Orlok. And then there was Noel Coward, who wrote When They Went to London. That's right. The Grand Guignol tried to take it on the road a little bit, and they set up at the Little Theater on the Strand in 1920 in London, but it was only there for 2 years. Not because no one wanted to see it, but because the Lord Chamberlain was not keen on it. The British theatrical censor didn't like stage blood, so they had to do a lot of strangulations instead of what they normally did. And then there was one where an adulterous couple were trapped in a flat when the ceiling came down and crushed them to death. But it's the only thing they could get away with instead of eye gouging. They also did some other things. As I told you, though, there were sex farces, but they couldn't do those there either. They were fine in France, and they were banned in Britain. I love my British people out there, but I have to say, I feel like in the past they've been strangely repressed in some fashions. But then y'all like to just get drunk and tear loose. Maybe you're tired of being repressed. You know I love you, I'm just kidding. But it's a fact, it didn't do so well there, it was banned. It did good business through the 20s in France. After World War II, it started to struggle. It actually stayed open during the war, and controversially was very popular with the occupying German forces. And as I recall, the Germans loved to go see movies and stuff there too. They loved to do a lot of things there. They liked Paris, as far as I remember and can tell. So although the shows went on until 1962, as you might imagine, after the occupation, horror plays probably hit too close to home. They'd already seen enough horror. They'd already experienced enough. They had trauma, so much trauma that, you know, maybe this wasn't so much fun anymore. You can find all kinds of, there's people who do, you know, thesis and stories about what the climate of the world often coincides with what we watch, like vampires are popular during certain times and zombies are, you know, etc. It all kind of ties in. Another factor, though, was the rise of cinema. It started to be more films. They started to be better. In the 60s, you know, you could go see Psycho or Les Diaboliques, which is a famous French horror. You can see close-ups and zoom-in shots, you know, and special effects. They start to have special effects. And that contributed to the decline of the theater itself. Now I want to take you a bit behind the scenes, shall we say, from Mr. Eric Hart, The Gore of Grand Guignol. And I'm just going to read straight from the website now because he's got a wonderful thing going on here. He is, by the way, a prop builder and a professor of stage properties at the University of North Carolina School of the Arts. And he wrote this in 2010, October. The fan of both horror and theater is sure to have heard of Grand Guignol. Though a producer of a variety of works, the infamous Parisian theater is best known for its horror plays performed in the years leading up to World War II. Founded in, now this one he says 1894, by Oscar, I told you his name, offered up stories such as Les Laboratoires des Hallucinations, I mentioned that one to you. Anyone familiar with EC Comics will recognize the kind of plots this theater performed. When a theater regularly displays amputations, burning in acid, evisceration, stabbings, and all other manner of violent actions, a prop person may ask, how realistic were these effects, and how were they pulled off? One of the perhaps best-kept secrets of the Grand Guignol was their fake blood. Many sources speak in fascination that it would congeal after a few minutes like real blood. Mel Gordon, a theater professor at UC Berkeley and Grand Guignol expert, says that the base is made of a heated mixture of equal parts carmine and glycerin. Carmine is a bright red pigment made by boiling dried insects. You can find paints which use that pigment, though finding it in its pure form is more difficult and necessitates looking for specialty online stores. You can buy glycerin at drugstores and online. It is often added to stage blood to give it a bit of a sheen under the lights. This apparently remains a theory, however. Quote, the theater has a secret recipe for blood. When the stuff cools, it coagulates and makes scabs. Thrill-hungry customers in the small auditorium get a dividend when they overhear the hoarse backstage whisper, Heat! Edmond! Warm up the blood! Vite is quickly. Vite, vite! Edmond Bouvet was the chief prop man of the theater in the mid-1940s. The last director of the theater, Charles Nunon, personally mixed 9 different shades of blood daily. We learn more about the possible ingredients of this fake blood from 2 articles about the tour of Grand Guignol, which hit San Francisco in 1950. Director Robert T. Ellie called on local druggist Barnes Hind for a 2% solution of method cellulose. I'm going to make the assumption that both of these articles are actually talking about methyl cellulose. It thickens in cold water and gels when heat is added. You can buy it in its pure form or find it in popular constipation medications. That's interesting. It was used to make the ectoplasm in Ghostbusters. There's a little tidbit for you. Blood which did not need to flow could be made from currant jelly. Currants, that means you could probably eat it too. Tasty, tasty. Nonon also made viscera from red rubber hose and sponges soaked in blood. Taxidermist supplied animal eyeballs, which he coated in aspic, and that's a clear jelly made from meat stock. And I've kind of seen that. It does look ewy gooey. And stuffed with anchovies, marinated in blood. Sheep's eyes were popular, but any animal would suffice because then the eyeball could bounce when dropped. Oh my God, so I guess they used real eyeballs. Edible eyeballs were made by a local confectioner's shop. A tongue that was ripped out was made of rubber. And, according to the Columbia Encyclopedia of Modern Drama, Paul Ratineau, the man who I mentioned as a stage manager, depended on the daily delivery of fresh animal parts by local butchers. So, y'all, some of it was real. I wasn't human, but it was real. Now, in order to deliver the goods, a variety of devices and trick props were required. Deliver the goods as in give you a show. This would include rubber knives, concealed bladders, you know, like a bag, you know what I mean, container, tubes, and small strategically located steam pipes. A dagger squirting blood from a vial hidden in an actor's hand, for instance, quick flaming powders, a table with props hidden in the upstage drawers. Daggers with retractable blades could also squirt blood from the handles. There's a turkey baster, rubber ball, or an eyedropper could provide a good base for building a blood squirting knife. They have a photograph here that I'll share from Life magazine, showing someone with the trick knife, classic arrow through the head gag prop, where 2 halves are separated by a metal clasp, which then fits around the actor's limb or thumb or wherever. So it'll be easier. I'll just share these pictures with you. And they're showing somebody chopping off a hand. Quote, cutting off a man's hand is easier than it sounds. Stiffen a glove with glue water so it holds its shape and paint it like a real hand. The actor wearing the glove should still be able to move his fingers a bit. When the hand is chopped off, the, quote, chopper removes the glove and the choppee moves his hand up into his cuff, which is reinforced with a cardboard tube and fitted with a blood pack. The stiffened glove should hold its shape perfectly as the unwilling amputee writhes in pain. Are you grossed out yet? It's awesome. Another eye-popping effect involves hiding a fake eye in the hollowed-out handle of a spoon. Conversely, an actress could wear a plaster or latex quarter mask, which holds a fake sheep's eye, lactose powder, and a blood capsule. If she wears her hair over that half of her face, the effect would be quite flawless. Someone named Mel Gordon is describing a lot of these. Was he the expert? Yes. So another quote. The retractable blade of the knife moves into the handle, which squirts blood when pressed against the victim's face. Affixed to the end of the handle is a piece of adhesive skin, either latex or lambskin, with a slit to allow the blade to move through it. As the handle is pressed against the victim's eye, the sticky, quote, skin is pressed to the eyelid, leaving a gory, empty eye socket. When the knife handle is pulled away, the blade is released back into the position. The actor with the knife squeezes an air pump in the handle, and a rubber eyeball on the end of the knife inflates. The eye appears to be impaled on the tip of the knife. Many magic shops sell an inflatable ball and a pump mechanism that could work as a base for this prop. So, y'all, as I'm reading this, you know, it's deceptively simple, but what occurs to me is that everybody who's participating in the gag has to have perfect timing. You've got the person with the thing putting it over the eye and the other person and pushing and inflating, and then this person, like, everybody has to know their cues. You know, that's actually really impressive, because some of these you're going to have more than one person is in on it. It's not just one person doing the trick. Much of the development of the theater's effects are due to the above mentioned Paul Ratner. Many of the tricks were secret. Some even had patents. Most were devilishly simple, he says. Their power and Ratner's cleverness did not come solely from the tricks. He overcame a number of challenges. First, the stage itself was only 20 by 20, with the audience close enough to shake hands with the actors. Even closer than I thought, y'all. Second, the tricks needed to work consistently in full view of this audience while the actors performed in character with other actors with often crazed emotions. So like I said, man, y'all got to hit your cues. You got a whole lot of shit to remember. Ratner also developed much of the Grand Guignol's lighting, which apparently was very characteristic lighting. It set the mood, and it could also hide the imperfections in the prop trickery, and also guide your audience's eyes where you wanted them to go. The arrangement of the scenery and objects also combined with blocking, which means, you know, where you are on the stage, to direct or misdirect the audience's attention. Sound effects, also pioneered by Ratner, were critical in bridging the gap between what an audience saw and what they imagined they're seeing. Then, of course, you have dramatic tension and the power of marketing that helped sell the bloodshed portrayed on stage by warming the audience up to a heightened level of expectation. The mystery of the special effects themselves added to the legend surrounding the Grand Guignol. In other words, the actual trick props, as clever as they were, might seem crude and unrefined when studied under normal light and out of context, but on stage they were magnificent. When their money became tight, the theater would prefer to stab women rather than the men because their smaller costumes were cheaper to clean. So that's not sexism, y'all. They just had smaller, their clothing was cheaper to get to do. Conversely, for head wounds, men were victims because their short hair was easier to wash. Here's a quote from someone talking about some of their more serious mishaps and accidents. Naturally, all this gruesomeness is sheer illusion, but the sham is not always devoid of risk. Once, during an actress simulated hanging, the protective device broke and she almost did get hanged. Another recently was burned by the flame of a revolver. In one play called Orgy in the Lighthouse, the heroine suffered even more. On one night, she almost caught fire. On another, her male partner began to live his part a bit too much and beat her up in earnest, so that she was forced to go off to the country to nurse a nervous breakdown. Wow, what an asshole. I mean, there's method acting and then there's dude. Back off. And that is a little bit from someone who knows props about the Grand Guignol's props. A few little side notes. They did actually try to revive the Grand Guignol in London in 1945 under Frederick Whitney. It ran for 2 seasons at the Granville Theater. It did show some premieres of Whitney's own work and a few adaptations of the French originals. Richard Mazda has reintroduced New York audiences to the Grand Guignol. His acting troupe, the Queen's Players, have produced six main stage productions of Grand Guignol plays, and Mazda is writing new plays in the classic Guignol style. The sixth production, Theater of Fear, included Delord's famous adaptation of Poe's The System of Dr. Tarr and Professor Feather, or Le Système du Dr. Gaudron et Peplume, as well as two original plays, Double Crossed and The Good Death, alongside The Telltale Heart. The 1963 Mondo film Echo includes a scene which may have been filmed at the Grand Guignol Theater during its final years. Avant-garde composer John Zorn released an album called Grand Guignol by Naked City in 1992 in a reference to the darker side of our existence, which has been with us and always will be. And then you have Swiss theater company Compagnie Pied de Biche revisits the Grand Guignol genre in contemporary contexts. When they gotta throw these words at me, I can't say, since 2008. There is a recently formed London-based Grand Guignol company, Theatre of the Damned. Their first production was at the Camden Fringe in 2010 and produced the award-nominated Grand Guignol in November of that year. 2011, they staged Revenge of the Grand Guignol at the Courtyard Theatre in London as part of London Horror Festival. Between 2011 and 2016, Baltimore-based Yellow Sign Theatre performed Grand Guignol productions in a very heavily updated version of Le Système du Dr. Gaudron et Peplume, as well as integrating Guignol elements into other performances. November 2014, 86 years after the last show of Alfred Senatis, La Campagne di Grand Guignol, founded in 1908, which had been the only example of Grand Guignol in Italy, the Convivio d'Art Company presented in Milan Grand Guignol de Milan, Le Cabaret des Vampires. The show was an original tribute to Grand Guignol, a horror vaudeville with various horror and grotesque performances such as monologues, live music, and burlesque, with satirical black humor conduction. One of the more prominent examples of Grand Guignol in television is Hannibal. Every episode includes at least one grisly murder, and Hannibal Lecter, the main protagonist, is a cannibal that the audience gets to see specifically choosing his victims, removing their organs, and cooking them into a feast that he serves to his unsuspecting friends and colleagues at the FBI. If you guys didn't see that one with Mads Mikkelsen, it was fantastic, and you should look it up and see if you can watch it. What was it, 3 seasons? It was very good. I had not even put that together, but that makes perfect sense. It would absolutely fall under Grand Guignol. The show's artistic design and display of the corpses calls to mind images from Grand Guignol Theater, featuring weekly macabre images such as a human totem pole made out of dismembered corpses. Grand Guignol plays a prominent role in Ib Melchior's World War II novel Codename Grand Guignol from 1987. In which a small group of actors from the theater team up with the French resistance and use their special skills to infiltrate Hitler's construction of a secret weapon, the V3 cannon. Melchior explains in the postscript that he based the novel on his own experiences as an actor in France, where he befriended the stage manager of the Grand Guignol and learned many of its secrets. It's probably a lot more influences than even that, but there is a little taste of something for spooky season. And shall we look up the Scream Queens? This is not a very long episode so far. Hang on. So I mentioned the woman that could have been known as the Scream Queen of the Grand Guignol, Paula Maxa. And I want to tell you a little something about her. And I just decided to Google up and go to crimereads.com because it has the wonderful headline, "The Most Murdered Woman in the World." How an early form of true crime set the stage for Paula Maxa, the original Scream Queen. When it comes to pinning down the first Scream Queen, most genre fans can easily find their way to Faye Ray, whose shriek was immortalized in 1933's King Kong. More dedicated film buffs might go back even further to silent movie stars such as Greta Schroeder. She was in Nosferatu, the Golem, how he came into the world, and Mary Philbin, who was in The Phantom of the Opera and The Man Who Laughs. While all these women left indelible marks on cinema, singling any of them out as the first Scream Queen makes two assumptions, that the archetype was birthed on celluloid and that she belongs exclusively to the horror genre. In fact, the woman who can most credibly lay claim to the title was a stage actress, and she owed her stardom to a theater whose roots were bound up in a fetal form of true crime writing. In genre criticism, the term grand guignol is a favorite descriptor for horror or crime tales that emphasize grisly violence and scenery-chomping melodrama. The term is a reference to Le Théâtre du Grand Guignol, an infamous fin de siècle Paris playhouse that treated its enthusiastic audiences to so-called hot and cold shower program of short plays that interspersed lurid tales of murder, rape, torture, and revenge with lighthearted sex farces. While the plays eventually metastasized into gory spectacles that reportedly had theater-goers fainting in the aisles, early productions borrowed more heavily from sensational news stories and crime fiction than horror. The theater, housed in a former church, was founded in 1897 by Oscar Metenier, a playwright who had spent years working as a secretary to Paris's police commissioner. There's a little extra tidbit for you. Some sources say Metenier was what was known as chien de commissaire, or the commissioner's dog, a role that would have entailed accompanying condemned inmates during their final hours before execution. Maybe that's where he got his morbidity from. Metenier was intimately familiar with the city's criminal underground, and he developed a deep sympathy for people who, as he saw it, often had no other path available to them. He conceived the Grand Guignol as a venue that would spotlight the naturalism movement, staging slice-of-life productions that often centered on working-class Parisians and those forced into criminal activity by circumstances they couldn't control. Some of these early tales were even inspired by what might have passed for true crime in turn-of-the-century France. Macabre news briefs known as fait divers, which offered short accounts of violent and often sensational crimes that didn't quite warrant featured treatment. Limited to only a few of the texts, they went a step beyond simple reportage, often adding a dramatic or ironic flair. The 2011 book Novels in Three Lines contains more than 1,000 such items written by Félix Fénion, who was credited with turning the salacious news briefs into an art form. A few examples. Nurse Elise Bachmann, whose day off was yesterday, put on a public display of insanity. Responding to a call at night, M. Servant, cafe owner of Casa Rouge Guard, opened his window. A rifle shot destroyed his face. Sheed, of Dunkirk, fired 3 times at his wife. Since he missed every shot, he decided to aim at his mother-in-law and connected. A certain mad woman arrested downtown falsely claimed to be Nurse Elise Bachmann. The latter is perfectly sane. Under Metenier's guidance, the Grand Guignol drew freely from faits divers and openly acknowledged their influence. Metenier's 15-minute play, Lui, which means him, about a prostitute who slowly realizes she's locked in a room with a deranged killer, even opens with its characters reading a digest filled with grim news bites. The theater was an immediate success, but in 1898, Metenier sold his interest to Max Moret. That's where I got, maybe that's why there's the two dates. He had it in 96. Okay, that's now cleared up. Moret, I already told you, dialed up the violence and he had more lurid and gritty crime tales. He pushed the offerings into horror, but was the Grand Guignol's third director, a former actor named Camille Choisy, who gave Paris's Chapel of Terror its high priestess. In 1917, 3 years after he took over, Choisy hired a young actress who had recently appeared on screen in Les Vampires, a 10-part crime serial by French filmmaker Louis Foulard. The qualities that made Paula Maxa such a powerful screen presence translated beautifully to the stage, and Maxa, often billed simply by her last name, became a sensation. Throughout the 20s and 30s, she died so many times on stage at the Grand Guignol that she was known as the most murdered woman in the world. In one estimation, she suffered as many as 10,000 grisly deaths during her tenure at the theater. She was stabbed, shot, hanged, poisoned, strangled, guillotined, and steamrolled. She was stung by scorpions, kissed by lepers, eaten by pumas, and diced into 83 pieces. Thanks to the theater's ingenious makeup and lighting effects, she even decomposed on stage. An illusion so popular, she repeated it for 200 performances. Even critics who excoriated the theater for its over-the-top displays of violence and sex, and the blatant linking of the two, were enthralled by Max's performances. She became known as the Sarah Bernhardt of the Impasse Chaptal. The Impasse Chaptal was the cul-de-sac in which the theater was located. Constructing a definitive account of Max's life is difficult, in part because she seemed happy to give her fans exactly the kind of lurid backstory they might have expected. We know she was born in Marie-Thérèse Beau in 1898, and she grew up in Paris's Bohemian Montmartre district, which was home to iconic cabarets such as Moulin Rouge and Les Chats Noirs. According to a 1938 autobiography, Max's parents were well off and decidedly old-fashioned, and her early childhood was idyllic. If we believe Max's memoir, more on that later, her life took a grim turn when she was 15 and her 17-year-old boyfriend took her to the woods, worked himself into such a lustful frenzy that he assaulted her and slashed her throat. She awoke in the hospital and asked for her attacker, not wanting him to be punished, only to learn a few days later that he had killed himself after the assault. The incident, Maxa suggests, was a grim portent of things to come. If Max's memoir were a murder board, there'd be a taut red string connecting that attack and her career as Paris's favorite victim. "Bloodlust followed me as a curse," she writes. "Even in my stage career, I felt this curse. From the beginning, I was given roles of victimized women. It is no wonder that most of my fan mail dealt with murder, sadism, and fiendish perversions. The men who were drawn to me followed a tragic course. They became insane, killed in lust, and killed themselves." In Max's telling, she married a French count at the age of 16, but soon found herself bored with married life and left her husband to become an actress. She found her way to the Grand Guignol, first as a spectator, an adaptation of Robert Louis Stevenson's The Suicide Club, made quite the impression on her. She was in distinguished company as a house regular. Anais Nin attended shows at the theater. So did a young Ho Chi Minh, who lived in Paris for several years. Holland's Princess Wilhelmina, who would later become Queen of the Netherlands, also visited the Grand Guignol, and King Carol II of Romania liked it so much he supposedly kept a private bedroom at the theater. Maxa became an understudy in a production called Laboratory of Hallucinations and soon got a chance to go on stage when the actress cast in the role fell ill. She was quickly dubbed the Princess of Blood, became a fan favorite and critical darling. She was a must-see in her day. Laboratory of Hallucinations, about a brain surgeon who exacts gruesome revenge on his wife's lover by inserting needles into the man's brain to drive him insane, only to become a victim of his victim's macabre visions, set the precedent for Max's tenure at the Grand Guignol. "In all my following roles, I had to shriek and torture, wade in blood, disembowel people, and descend to the profoundest depths of madness." According to her memoir, Max's private life became a bizarre reflection of the performances that made her a sensation. She tells several stories of driving previously well-behaved men to lives of crime and fetishistic violence. As she tells it, a businessman named Maurice fell for her and spent so much money transforming her apartment into a lavish death chapel that he was arrested for some vague financial crime. She was never sure what the charges were. After selling her jewels to hire a lawyer to defend him, she fell in love with the attorney. The case dragged on and on until one evening, Maurice, somehow freed from jail, burst into Max's dressing room at the Grand Guignol and tried to kill her while the attorney cowered behind her wardrobe. Maxa later found out that the lawyer had intentionally postponed Maurice's trial to keep him in jail, and Maurice had secretly obtained another counselor who quickly secured his release. If her memoir beggars belief, in other words, you know, if you think it's full of shit, there's a good reason. It's titled, "I Am the Maddest Woman in the World," and it first appeared in 1938 issue of True, a men's magazine by the publisher of True Confessions. Not exactly a credible source, and one that would almost certainly have encouraged Maxa to exaggerate aspects of her life. It's probably wise to take these with a grain of salt, but a factual timeline of her career, including detailed accounts of some of her performances, is buried in the outlandish tales of violent obsession and sadomasochism that appeared in True. In other sources, including a decidedly tamer 1965 memoir, she offers lighthearted memories of her time at the Grand Guignol, such as smuggling out batches of the theater's gooey stage blood, which was made from gooseberry jelly, to make tartines. In all accounts, though, she remembers being stalked by obsessed patrons and receiving almost nightly death threats. What isn't included in any of Max's biographies is social context. Between two world wars, when Parisians were flocking to the Grand Guignol, French women were fighting a war of their own. While other Western countries had long since granted white women the right to vote, France did not do so until 1944. In Max's heyday, French women were still bound by stunningly misogynistic Napoleonic code, which, in some cases, afforded women fewer rights than children. Paula Maxa was being tortured and murdered night after night at a time when the French Senate was routinely blocking suffrage bills that were passing with overwhelming support in lower chambers. And this is a really great article that I'm going to stop here. I am going to link it because it's very long. I'm going to link it in the show notes. And now you know about the Scream Queen of the Grand Guignol. And you know a little bit about the Grand Guignol. I hope you enjoyed this episode. Please find me at Twitter, at PodPinky. And if you want to see some photographs and pictures of her and some playbills and things, Instagram is Pinky_podcast. My official website is pinkyswordpress.com. Please check out my newest novel, Dark Wings, urban fantasy, male-male romance. There's a vampire in there. No, there's no Grand Guignol. Sorry, this one is not a gory one. Well, maybe in a couple parts, but no, not really. Well, just go read it. Don't make me explain it. Just go read it. Check it out. It's on Amazon, available everywhere, even Kindle Unlimited. Go. Get it. And if you like physical copies like I do, it's also on paperback. Okay, there's my pitch. I hope you enjoyed this episode. I think I'm going to try to come up with some more spooky ones now, since I have declared it spooky season. You can always write to me, sroyd@pinkyswordpress.com, if you've got any good ghost stories I could share, or UFOs, or whatever. Or let me know on Twitter something that you think would be a cool story. And until next time, stay bloody. Boop, 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 bow.